Hello and welcome to Heresy, the show that argues against received wisdom. This is where you hear the unexpected. Like Lady Gaga saying, "Have you got something a little more demure? I'd feel silly in this." Unfortunately, Lady Gaga can't be with us. She's having a quiet night at home with Lord Gaga. It's Jigsaw night. In her place, I'm delighted to welcome comedians Natalie Haynes and Marcus Brigstock and God's own heretic, the Reverend Richard Coles. We're going to hear three opinions which the majority of people hold, and we're going to tell people they're wrong. Our first one involves a weighty, troublesome, and difficult issue that affects us all: transport strikes.
The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round. The wheels on the bus go round and round all day long.
Of course, the wheels on the bus don't go round and round if the driver's on strike. 83% of our live audience here agree with the opinion transport strikes are bad for commuters. When commuter trains or even planes are stopped by industrial action, it hits real people with real jobs. Estate agents, management consultants, PR executives, but also real people with real jobs. Marcus Brigstock, why should these people actually be welcoming the strikes?
Because at the end of a day of transport strikes, you get such wonderful and fascinating stories on the news as to how people bravely and gallantly made it into work with their terrific, endlessly hilarious tales of pluck is really what it is. Just people going, "I crawled to work on my chin. It was brilliant." And, so just for those wonderful stories, you know?
Well, I think people generally do want to get to work. That's why they're annoyed with the strike. But I also think people who work on the railways probably want to get to work. So, Natalie Haynes, wouldn't you think if they're not going into work, they might have a good reason?
Yeah, I'd think, woo, day off. That's what I'd be thinking. I'd be thinking, brilliant. One, I don't have to be on a train. Trains, buses, are full of germs. It doesn't matter how you look at it, they are basically pigeons, right?
Except slower.
What do you think, Richard Coles? Good excuse not to go to work?
I'm all in favour of transport strikes. I think they encourage the building up of moral fibre. I did have a lapse, I have to say, going up to Glasgow the day after the volcanic cloud came across. All the seat reservation system broke down on the Virgin Pendolino.
It goes past my window.
Are there these guys sitting in our seats? And I went, "Excuse me, you're in our seats." And then about half an hour later I said, "Look, okay, are you going to move?" And they said no. And I thought, well, I'll go get the train manager. And I thought, no, I'm not going to get the train manager. I felt enormously morally superior until about Penrith, when I finally did evict them from the seats and got to sit down. But good to feel morally superior, don't you think?
I live truly over a station, and every now and then they decide to do a bit of engineering work in the middle of the night. One, they shine quite bright lights into my house. Don't do that, it's annoying. Two, at one point, about 3 weeks ago, at 1:30 in the morning, there was a strange scratching noise outside our window, and it turned out to be a man hitting the platform with a broom. That is not maintenance. If he goes on strike, no one will miss him.
Generally, though, they're on strike because they think there's something wrong with the train service. So I'm assuming that people that are against this think that everything on the railways runs smoothly and efficiently. Marcus Brigstock, have you ever travelled by train?
Yes, no, I have, very often. And they are obviously terrific because so many people seem so very keen to get on there. I mean, whenever I've been on in the mornings, you can't keep people out. No matter how firmly you stand across the doorway. I mean, they literally love it. It's like Alton Towers. Really, really exciting. And I think a day off from that, when there is a strike, is quite a nice thing. It's like when we get a snow day. That's brilliant. You just see people making eye contact with each other and realising there are other human beings, and then obviously hurrying away because it's awful. But
it's become a sort of lifestyle choice. I mean, I was interested about militant trolley dollies, British Airways strike. I mean, it's not flat caps and sandwiches and beer, is it? I mean, it's kind of odd, that. The idea of a militant trolley dolly.
I like the idea of BA's cabin staff having flat caps and beer. You're out for a drink.
But it's true, the newspapers try to paint them as these kind of militant revolutionaries. They're cabin group. They're people who draw a curtain between first class and economy. Mm. Natalie, can you imagine those people as revolutionaries?
No. No, I can't. Because, in essence, and I realise that they will all now write to me and say, oh, if we weren't there, then... Right, if you weren't there, then, like in every other plane crash, everyone would die, and everyone would die. All you do is bring me a large gin after there was some turbulence and we didn't die. So... thank you for the gin, but I could get my own gin. In my house, I get gin on my own all the time, and it's absolutely fine.
You mentioned the ash cloud before, Richard. Yeah. Of course, that stopped transport in a big way. People were stranded all over the world. Could you see any good in that?
Oh, lots and lots, yes. I think it's nice to stay put a bit, really. It was very good for me, because that was my week's holiday, and I was on the Mull of Kintyre. And the peace of that was not disrupted by EasyJet going overhead or bits of frozen lavatory falling onto the beach. And also there was no jet stream in the sky. It's great.
Some people said it was possible that there would be no planes all summer or all year. Is there a plus side to that?
I wouldn't have to go to a wedding of someone I barely like or know.
Plus, I think, you know, the two wars we've seen in the Middle East have really divided this country. But, you know, Iceland have done our banks and have now done our transport system. And I don't know about anyone else here, but I've always operated a three strikes and you're out thing. My feeling is their next move will be to kidnap Michael Palin. And then I think quite legitimately we can have them.
What they have in common, I suppose, the volcanic problems and the strikes, is that they both hit at our assumption that we can get on a form of fast transport at any point and get anywhere.
Yes.
Do we take that too much for granted?
Well, that's dangerous, isn't it? I mean, I found myself outside Bedford for about 4 hours in the middle of the night, because I got on a train at London to go to Kettering. It's not a long way. It's 48 minutes or something. And then everything just broke down. And I ended up, you know... 20 minutes in, and the day was completely lost. I was stranded in Bedfordshire, near a Sainsbury's, which wasn't open, waiting with 3,000 people for a replacement bus service, which was coming from Argyllshire, as far as I could tell.
Tell me this. How long would you have stood there before breaking into the Sainsbury's and stealing some food?
It was borderline, in my case. But the sandwich choice was fairly poor, being Bedfordshire. When the replacement bus service arrived, it was driven by a man who's very fond of country and western. He played it really loud, all the way to Kettering.
Excellent. Any particular artists?
I can't remember. It was a sort of aggressive country western, twangy banjo noise.
Oh, new country.
New country.
That's got some amazingly vicious lyrics as well.
Yeah.
Really nice.
Yeah.
Let's go over there and bomb those people back into the Stone Age. Jesus loves us, but he hates them.
You know the guy?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the audience here. Brian Jacobs, you strongly agree that transport strikes are terrible for commuters. You've been personally affected?
Yes, I'm planning to go to the States later this year. I'm not sure whether I should be booking the flight or not, so it could be preventing me going to a convention.
What is the nature of the convention?
It's a hypnotherapy convention.
But you just hypnotise the cabin crew into working.
Or have some hypnotherapy here and just pretend you've been. Yeah.
Physician, heal thyself.
Yeah. As they say.
Would you be less annoyed if you couldn't get to the convention because of volcanic cloud than industrial action?
Well, that's the other problem. The insurance company don't cover either the volcanic cloud or the BA strike. So if I book a ticket...
Are they both acts of God?
It seems like, yes.
Oh. Is a volcanic eruption an act of God?
Well... Speaking as a clergyman, no. Speaking as someone whose pension scheme relies on reinsurance, yes.
Well, I think we can wind that up there. So let's have a pat on the back for transport strikers who only want to improve the system like the rest of us. And they've never hampered our movements like the ash cloud has. That left people stranded all over the world. Even Whitney Houston was trapped during the first eruption after a concert in Dublin. She went to the ferry terminal, but there was an enormous line. And that perked her up enough to get on the ferry. Let's move on to a modern love story. It's the fairy tale romance of Prince William and Kate Middleton. Now, before we go any further, apparently 15% of our audience don't know who Kate Middleton is. I'm quite impressed. I'm hoping that means you're a room full of high-minded intellectuals. I'm worried it means you're all here on a day trip from Sweden and you're not going to understand any of it. But for the record, Kate Middleton is the girlfriend of Prince William, the heir to the throne, and they've been together for about 97 years. And at the time of recording, Kate Middleton and a breathless nation are still waiting for an engagement. Though journalists say Buckingham Palace has secretly cleared 2 days in June for an announcement. 2 days? Who's making the announcement? Neil Kinnock? Whether or not the happy couple are engaged by the time you're listening to this, 82% of our live audience believe Kate Middleton should get a job. That's even though 15% of you don't know who she is. You still think she should get out there in the workplace. Natalie Haynes, should Kate get a job?
She should not, for the excellent reason that, by and large, people in the orbit of the royal family are, for want of a better phrase, talent vacuums. And she used to work, I think, briefly for a clothing chain. Sarah Ferguson has written children's books. Some nondescript prince who looks a bit like Prince Charles but isn't worked for the really useful company and then have a TV production company. And these are all jobs that people would genuinely, you know, kill their own parents to get. So I kind of think there's already really high youth unemployment. Why don't we, since we're going to be keeping her anyway once she marries Prince William, why don't we just let somebody who'd really like the job, worked hard and didn't have millionaire parents have it? Ta-da!
A bit worrying, isn't it? There's nothing left to fall back on, because isn't her mother a trolley dolly?
I think they're millionaires.
Now, a millionaire trolley dolly.
Yeah, a millionaire trolley dolly.
People, I'm not going to... People are snobbish about Kate Middleton's mother, because she was cabin crew, and I'm not having that. She's a very good mother. She gave that child everything it needed. Miniature packets of peanuts, ginger ale, napkins. Richard Coles, you must give young couples advice all the time. What would you advise this prospective young bride?
Don't get a job.
For what reason?
Because monarchy should be ornamental. If you're going to have it ornamental. I don't want the Queen of England... I don't want to meet the Queen of England and think, you racked up my nectar points this morning.
Marcus, do you think Kate should get a job?
No, absolutely not. You know, I mean, she's sort of feckless and posh and self-important and opinionated and overprivileged and pompous. And frankly, I just don't want competition for what I already do. Yeah, I mean, I seriously don't think she should get a job, because in the long run, you know, the fewer people that meet Kate Middleton, the fewer biographies there will be later on.
If she was going to get a job, what sort of job should she get?
Colouring in?
Something in computers. Isn't that what everyone does now? What do you do? Something in computers. Right, that hasn't helped at all.
If Kate Middleton were going to get married and have children and raise a family, I'm sure she'd have a bit of help. But that would be valid in itself. I think the sense that she should get a job is part of, I think, too strict an idea all over, that it isn't enough just to get married and have children and run a house. And I think that is enough.
But a person is valued by the work that they do, as opposed to how nice they are or whether they get a round in.
Well, I bet Kate always gets a round in. Let's go to the audience. Where's Stuart
Webb?
She's
not in, is she?
Stuart Webb, you strongly agree that Kate Middleton should get a job. What job do you think she should get?
Chancellor.
You think she'd make a good chancellor?
Of the Exchequer.
Yes.
When people say about the royals that they're good with money, what they mean is two things. They're good with money.
Let me just clarify this, Mr. Webb. When you were given the ballot paper and you ticked the box, I strongly agree that Kate Middleton should get a job, it's because you think specifically she should be Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yes. very important.
I see.
Fairness, she hasn't spent all our money propping up the banks. So, overall, less annoying than previous chancellors, I would suggest.
I think, actually...
Only slightly.
Value for money. We get value for money from the royal family. We really do. They bring in more than we expend on them by a significant margin.
Yes, in essence, I believe that to be true, although the buildings that we have already paid for do play some part in that picture.
Sure.
I don't think, and I'm not actually a Republican, but I don't think if we did get rid of our royal family that people would go, well, I'm not going there anymore. I mean, unless we, in getting rid of them, smash the buildings down using them.
I mean, I used to be a Republican, and I'm not anymore. Partly because I'm a clergyman of the Church of England and the Queen is the Supreme Governor, OK? The other thing is, and I think it's key when you look at the election, I think it's good to have someone at the heart of public life who is not party political. I think it gives you... You know, now, some people might say that what you could have is a president to do that, but where do you get presidents from? And I'm not saying the royal family doesn't have its own political affiliations as kind of rich, landed, aristocratic kind of people. Of course they do. But I do think there's something about that which transcends party interest, and that's one of the reasons why Britain's a good place to live, on the whole.
Let's wind that up, anyway. No job for Kate Middleton. She isn't lazy, she's just old-fashioned. And if she becomes Queen Catherine, that will be a full-time job. And by full-time, I mean she'll never have to do anything ever again, and by job, I mean the opposite of job. Let's move on to our third and final received opinion.
He's a man with a plan, got a counterfeit dollar in his hand. He's Mr. Know-it-all. Playing hard, talking fast, making sure that he won't be the last.
Richard Dawkins. He knows everything, doesn't he? He's a confident atheist, or at least he says he is. You can never be sure about a man's religious convictions until you've sat next to him on a turbulent flight. Nevertheless, Dawkins has persuaded the world and 72% of our live audience that atheism is a more rational position than faith. In other words, the atheists are the smart, insightful, scientific thinkers. The believers are gibbering, superstitious loons. Luckily, we have one of those gibbering, superstitious loons right here. Reverend Richard Coles, what's wrong with eliding atheism and rationality?
I would put it the other way around. I think I'd want to know what's irrationality. Now, if by irrationality you mean standing on one leg in cost cutters saying, I'm Napoleon, fly me to the moon, then clearly that's irrational. If you suggest that the deep truths of living sometimes do not conform to expected patterns, if that's irrational, then I'm irrational. And I think, I mean, essentially with Richard Dawkins, I met him a little while ago and I was a bit scared, you know, it's kind of like meeting the Antichrist for me. And he came beetling over to me and he said, oh, you're Richard Coles, aren't you? And I said, yes. He said, I Googled you, we've got the same birthday. And I thought, typical Aries. He was absolutely charming, and I think he's brilliant. I think what he's done to put the ideas of Darwin within the reach of a general readership is absolutely fantastic. But all that intelligence and all that subtlety seems to just get switched off when he gets to religion, because I think it annoys him so much.
Marcus Brigstocke, what do you think of the atheist movement?
Well, I've got quite mixed feelings about it, really. I mean, I am an atheist, but by default, really, because atheism's not really a thing. It's an absence of a thing. It's saying, and I'm not one of them, which is fine as far as it goes, but, I mean, I don't like fennel. And I don't hang out with other anti-fennelists. You know, so I think a lot of it is irrational. I mean, I read The God Delusion and I read Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, and they're both... They're well worth a read, regardless of what you believe. I mean, they lay out very clearly how mankind has turned to religion when we'd have been better off facing the issues directly in front of us, how religion has hindered educational advances, how religion has led us...
By inventing the university, by inventing the school.
Yes.
I think what... Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was leading to a point in your favour, to be honest.
Oh, shut up.
Yeah, no, I mean, they show how, you know, how religion has hindered educational advances. They show how religion has led us time and time again into appalling acts of violence, and even goes so far as to suggest that religion may be holding us back from our next evolutionary step. All of which is very well argued in both of these books, until you realise that you cannot place the word religion with the word alcohol. And suddenly, all of the same things stack up in exactly the same ways, and it's quite disappointing. If you read The God Delusion and just replace the word God with beer, it still makes a great deal of sense. But there is a more serious point behind that flippant joke, which is that, you know, people do seek comfort in mad and crazy things.
Can I just say, it's a mistake to think that people do religion because they seek comfort. That's
do you
incidental.
Think so?
No, you seek it because you seek something dynamic that offers a transformation of how you live, that offers life in its fullness. It's not comfort, it's challenge, actually.
Natalie, are you a Dawkins fan?
That's a tricky one. I am, because, like Richard, I think he's a tremendous arguer, and I like people who do polemic. I find it interesting. But I am not an atheist, which will surprise those 8 people who bought copies of The Atheist's Guide to Christmas, in which I had an essay. I wrote the piece, but I am agnostic, because I think it's the smartest, most rational position you can choose, because it seems to me that atheism is a very definite thing to say. I definitely think there definitely isn't. I know that there isn't a God. Well, I don't know that. And when I was about 19, I read Protagoras, because I didn't go out much. And there's a very good quote at the start of book of Protagoras, which is, on the subject of the gods, he says, "I am unable to say whether they exist or not. There are many obstacles to such knowledge, including the brevity of human life and the obscurity of the subject." And I went, yeah, that's me. That's how I feel. There it is right there. And that was quite a while ago now, and I haven't really... I kind of went, yep, that's it. That's why I'm agnostic. I'm agnostic because I think it's unknowable. I don't have the resources required to know more than I do. So, agnostic, and therefore I find atheism a strangely irrational position to take.
What do you get of religious people doing religion? I mean, did you go to a carol service, Natalie? Would that kind of stuff offer anything to you?
I quite like singing.
Yeah.
But I don't get asked to carol services. I get asked to do the Godless Christmas shows, so I do those.
I've been asked to
do the Godless Christmas show?
Yes.
Did they have a wrong number?
It was that night. No. I was on a discussion program with that nice man who runs it, and I ponced a fag off him afterwards, and we were chatting, and he said, "Would you like to come on the Atheist show?" I thought, "Yeah, why not? Church of England, of course."
Agnosticism strikes me as the most rational.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
Position.
But the thing is, no one understands what it is. So you go, "I'm agnostic." "Oh, I can't make your mind up." "No, given it more thought than you have." Duh.
Although there are quite a few agnostics for whom no further research seems to be necessary. Do you know what I mean? They just go, "Yeah, I don't know, tricky, yeah." "I was going to look into it, but there's a new season of The Wire out on DVD."
The novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez said, "I don't believe in God, but I'm afraid of him." That's basically my attitude to TV detector vans. You know, I sort of know they don't exist, but I don't want to risk the fine. That's quite a common attitude, though, isn't it, Richard? I mean, is that what agnosticism is? Saying, "I'm not sure, but I'm not prepared to take the risk"?
People get terribly worked up about belief. And I think I used to, because I was an atheist until I was about 29. And when I was 28, I remember thinking, in a world of uncertainty, at least I know I will never be religious. 6 months later, I was signed up. And it's not about... You know, people worry about you have to believe things, that it's got to be all neat and orderly. And I think perhaps that's symptomatic of the times we live in, where people do want a certain model of rationality which suggests that things do need to be neat and tidy. But actually, the really important things that inform our lives that we live by are not neat and tidy. And I'm sure that's just as true for Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett as it is for me.
What's baffling to me as a non-believer is not that you might believe in God, is that you believe in that God. I don't find the Hitchens-Dawkins position comforting or comfortable or anything. I would like to believe in God, but the Christian God, the Muslim God, the Jewish God, you can keep him. He is absolutely revolting. He's racist. Ooh. He's misogynist. He's genocidal. He's
okay, look, first of all...
Can I just respond to that?
Yes.
And then all bets are off when you get to, and I have to say, Jesus Christ, when that's all off.
Who
it's game over.
Who endorses the Old Testament. I mean, I'd love to believe
transcends
in Jesus.
Transcends the Old Testament and offers you a new way of living, an end to cruelty, destructiveness, self-seeking, new life, life in its fullness.
And can I also say, Mark, that the person who believes that the Old Testament is literally the word of God is the person who smacks Leslie Grantham in a supermarket for the way he treated Angie. I mean, you don't have to read it word for word, and that's not the point. The point is not whether you like God, whether you understand or can know God. It's whether it is more rational, therefore, to believe that there is no God. You can't say, just because I don't like what it says in the book, he doesn't exist.
I mean, it kind of is more rational to say there is no God, if you're going to compute evidence in that sort of way. But my point would remain that actually, what's, you know, as Oscar Wilde said, isn't it, the truth is never likely or and rarely simple or something like that. I can't remember where. And it's true, isn't it? The kind of deep things which inform you, the stuff you remember on your deathbed, are not things which necessarily conform to a kind of easy formula. It's mysterious and paradoxical. And what I love about religion, the way I try to do it, is that it allows me to live with some honesty and integrity, cross fingers, with that sort of paradox. And I find that rich and rewarding.
But also it depends on the kind of God you want. Right. I mean, a good example of rational God-believing is the king of the Greek god Zeus, who's always coming down to earth and impregnating women, and then they have demigod children. Well, if you were a woman and married to a king who'd gone off to fight a war somewhere and you inadvertently got up the duff, then going, Zeus did it. It's a rational position.
I like the Norse gods, the gods of the northern pantheon. They'd do for me very nicely if I wasn't signed up already.
So you've got a plan B in place. The Church of England doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Let's draw the programme to a close. But is this really the end? Or will it carry on afterwards in some other form? We can't be sure. Actually, we can be sure. It's the end of the programme. Thanks very much to my guests, Richard Coles, Natalie Haynes and Marcus Brigstocke. Good night.
Heresy was written and presented by Victoria Corran with additional material by Charlie Skelton. The show was created by David Baddiel and produced by Brian King. Heresy is an Avalon production for BBC Radio 4. In next week's programme, David Baddiel, Polly Vernon and Dave Gorman argue against the received wisdom that Ashley Cole is a bad person.